Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Very good to have you with us, and thank you for your participation in this very special California Public Radio Day. We begin by the huge news in the sports world. Late yesterday, it began with the Milwaukee Bucks NBA team not coming out of the team's locker room to protest the most recent police shooting, this one happening in nearby Kenosha, Wisconsin, Kenosha, Wisconsin, just a couple of days before the scheduled Game 5 playoff game involving the Milwaukee Bucks. But then it spread to other NBA teams who decided they would not play their games, including the Los Angeles Lakers last night. Other sports decided to cancel three Major League Baseball games.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Games, including the Dodgers-Giants game, was postponed as a result of the social justice protest. The WNBA canceled all of its games that were scheduled for last night, and there were Major League Soccer games also postponed as a result of the action. NBA players as well as NBA owners met this morning to talk about the future of the league's playoffs that are well underway. Joining us to talk about where things are inside the bubble in Orlando is Los Angeles Times reporter covering the Lakers, Tanya Ganguly. Tanya, so good to have you with us again. What is the word on the potential for the season and the playoffs to resume?
Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, they are planning to resume the playoffs. They're just trying to figure out when it would be appropriate to do that. It sounds like there's some momentum for playing the games that were supposed to happen yesterday, playing those games tomorrow, and then playing today's games on Saturday, and just moving things back a couple of days. But, you know, the players, there are a lot of consequences to what the players were considering doing, to what some of them, LeBron James and Kawhi Leonard in particular, wanted to do, which was just end this and go home. There are consequences to that. The Lakers and the Clippers really had the most to lose of any team, which made it interesting that they were the ones who said, let's not do this. Let's just all go home yesterday. But, you know, there were lots of conversations with different players discussing what the right steps would be and what all those consequences would be. And so this is what they have decided to resume.
Okay. And what's the thinking as to why the two Los Angeles teams, of all the teams still alive in the playoffs, were the only two to vote to suspend the rest of the season and go home?
It probably has a lot to do with the level of influence that those two particular teams have. They will be heard no matter what. LeBron James will be heard no matter what. And I think that there were some players who worried about losing their platform if they weren't still in the playoffs. You know, there's a matter of money, too. There's players who are still establishing themselves in their careers. And if, you know, in the sort of Armageddon situation of this affecting, you know, their collective bargaining agreement, all of those other things, that could hurt some of the players too. But I think that, you know, two of the leading voices last night saying, like, this, what's going on now is important for us to take a really strong stance on and end the season. The two of the leading voices were LeBron James and Kawhi Leonard. So I think that's why, you know, those are two guys they're the two best players on their teams, and they have a lot of influence, and, you know, that is how they felt last night.
Any decision on prosecuting the officer who shot Jacob Blake in Kenosha, presumably at least a few days away? We just heard on NPR News that the investigation into the shooting is going on. State legislators are looking at a number of police reform bills, but even in California, which is police reform friendly, it appears that the most far-reaching of those measures are unlikely to be voted out of the legislature this year. What is it specifically players are hoping will come from the boycott of last night's games, and what sort of timeliness do they want to see in a political and law enforcement response?
Well, I hope that we'll get a lot more answers about exactly what caused the sudden boycott and exactly where their minds were. I do know that last night I was sitting in the hallway outside of the Milwaukee Bucks game day locker room, and they showed up to the arena around like 1 o'clock, a little after one, ready to play. They went out to warm up. Some of them had their uniforms on. And then in the next 3 hours, until the game was going to start, they decided not to play as a team. It was an effort led by Sterling Brown, who has had a bad experience with police in Milwaukee, and George Hill, and who the other day was saying we shouldn't have even come here. So those two sort of led this effort. And by the end of, for the next 3 hours, starting around 4 p.m. until about 7 p.m., they were on the phone with Milwaukee's lieutenant governor. They were on the phone with politicians up there that they felt that they could pressure to prosecute the police officers. And so I think that that's a first step that they want. They've talked a lot about their pain over seeing this, over this kind of thing happening so often to Black people, and I think that they just wanted to figure out what they could do and figure out if, there was talk for days about potentially boycotting. I think they wanted to actually do it and then try to figure out what real things they could do that would make change.
So this didn't come out of the blue. These discussions had been ongoing. One of the things I'd heard was that there were some complaints that the Buck players had not consulted with the Players Association or with members of other teams, who, of course, would have a ripple effect from this and did have a significant effect.
Well, I would disagree that this didn't come out of the blue. What I would say is, yes, there were conversations, people saying, like, maybe the right thing to do would be to boycott. But really, the teams that we heard that from, that kind of language from, were the 76ers and the Toronto Raptors and the Boston Celtics, who were supposed to start a playoff series today, their Eastern Conference semifinals. And they were talking a lot about maybe we should all go home. I don't know. It was a very abstract, though. The fact that the Bucks actually did this, that did come out of the blue. Nobody knew it was going to happen. Even some of the players on the Bucks didn't know. It wasn't something that was planned in advance. It was something that kind of just happened. And I think we'll find out over the next few days why it happened when it did.
Love to hear from listeners. What do you think of the NBA players' actions, beginning with the Milwaukee Bucks, their arena just about 40 miles from Kenosha, Wisconsin, where the young man Jacob Blake was shot in the back as he was leaning into his car? He's been left with very serious injuries. There have been a series of protests held in cities across the United States, most notably in Kenosha itself. What do you think of what the players did? We're at 866-893-KPECC. You can also post on the AirTalk page at kpecc.org. Tanya, were the players, as a part of these discussions, able to get more from the league in terms of the league taking an additional stand against police abuse?
That's not clear yet. The NBA's Board of Governors decided they were meeting this morning also, and their meeting went quite a bit longer than the players' meeting did. The players' meeting, the Lakers had an individual players-only meeting just with their own team this morning. Once they broke that meeting, they had kind of had a change of heart overnight as they continued talking to each other. They broke that meeting and they went into the big one, and almost immediately the whole group decided, like, no, we should go back to playing. But while they were doing that, the Board of Governors was meeting, and they still do want to see more out of the owners, more out of the Board of Governors, in terms of what they're doing, but it's not clear at this point you know, what, if anything, that will change for them.
We're talking with Los Angeles Times reporter who covers the Lakers. It's her beat, Tanya Ganguly. She's been inside the bubble since the start of the NBA's resumption of season, now into the playoffs with the Los Angeles Lakers leading the Portland Trail Blazers in that series, 3-1. A little bit later, we're talking with her Times colleague, columnist Dylan Hernandez, and Kavitha A. Davidson of the Lead podcast from The Athletic. That coming up as we'll continue, and we'll take your calls at 866-893-5722. Also take your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. So with the players being willing to resume, is it clear that ownership is going to want to resume the season, or is there any concern that ownership might be fearful the players might have a boycott in the future that would be disruptive? Are they clearly on board with a resumption?
I believe so. I don't think that the owners have considered not resuming. I think they were probably hoping that it would resume as fast as possible. So I think really the big question now is waiting to see, you know, what they're willing to do. You know, now that the players have said that they're playing, it'll be interesting to see how the owners react to that. If they do feel like they need to take more steps, or if they feel like, well, the games are going to go on again, so it's not really that important to do it.
Tanya, thank you so much. We appreciate it. I know you're on everything that's happening there. We look forward to your continuing coverage of this major event, combining sports and the world of social justice. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Tanya Ganguly of the Los Angeles Times. Debbie in West Adams says, I totally support the NBA boycott. This doesn't come out of the blue. It's cumulative. The black community has had enough. This is a natural boiling over. Debbie, she said it didn't come out of the blue. She said that this had been something that had been talked about for quite a while. So it was a surprise, I think, to people that last night was the night that it happened. But this was a conversation about a potential boycott, John, you described, that had been going on for quite a while. We'll take calls from Dennis and Frank when we come back. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC and the KPECC app.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, in case you just joined us. It appears the NBA playoffs will resume, though the game scheduled for today will be postponed. The tentative plan is the games would resume tomorrow, but the NBA got the attention of the world with its boycott last night, not just in the Milwaukee Bucks playoff game. They were the first team to not take the court in protest. Then the two other games, including the Laker Trailblazer playoff game, postponed as well. Other sports followed suit. Three MLB games were postponed, including the Dodgers and the Giants last night. Major League Soccer postponed its slate of games last night. Even the tennis tournament that was scheduled to have games played last night, those matches were postponed as well. I welcome your input on this and what you see as the significance of the professional sports world boycott. We're at 866-893-KPECC. Dennis in Pasadena, what do you think?
Larry, I'm only calling about this most recent occurrence. You said earlier that Jacob was shot while he was trying to get into his vehicle. And from the video, you can see that apparently he is trying to aggressively get into the vehicle. Isn't it premature? Again, only talking about this recent shooting. Isn't it premature for this action on the part of the league to happen until we actually know why was he trying to get into the vehicle? I heard reports that he had admitted he had a knife. Personally, I would never turn my back on a cop, ever. And so where does personal responsibility come into play, and where does having all the facts first and always presuming that it's the cop's fault, it undermines the whole case.
So, Dennis, your feeling is this was not the right case, unlike George Floyd's, to take the stand on.
Very well put.
Okay, Dennis, I appreciate your call. Yeah, I think that for many people, when a police officer shoots someone in the back, that is to them definitively a bad use of force, a bad decision on the part of the officer. And I understand, you know, police make the point that that is not clear-cut definitive in many cases. But I think for many members of the public, when they see that or when they hear of an instance where a member of the public is shot in the back, that is de facto, as for many people, the person being unarmed, that is seen as a de facto unnecessary use of force. Frank in Echo Park, you're on Air Talk.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I think I agree with the kneeling. I agree with the message that players are trying to invoke, and I agree that there is a systemic problem. But I think this time the players are overreaching by boycotting or planning on boycotting the whole playoffs. That's very unfair to the fans, and I think it's just. It has to do a lot with them wanting to go home to their families. I don't think they really want to be there.
Well, it sounds like they have decided that they do, in fact, want to play the playoffs. And I think it was just the Lakers and the Clippers who were the ones who said that they were ready to go home and boycott the rest of the season. All the other teams wanted to play and were ready to resume after making this social justice point. Frank, I appreciate your call. Dylan McGee writes on the page, I'm born and raised in Milwaukee. I'm proud the Bucks took this specific stand. They're a major revenue generator for the state of Wisconsin. And those tax dollars go toward funding the police. So it's the most effective form of protest because it directly affects how the state spends its money. Wisconsin is a quietly racist place that its citizens seem to ignore regularly, and multiple Bucks players can attest to this throughout the years. This is long overdue. That's Dylan writing on the Air Talk page at kpecc.org. Let's talk with Dylan Hernandez, sports columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Dylan, put this in perspective, if you will. I mean, this seems to me, when we look at historic political action by athletes, to be one of the biggest moves I can ever recall.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think one thing, you know, and just kind of referencing something your previous caller said, you know, just you need to consider, again, just let's start with the most basic level, right? These are professional athletes. Like, they want to play. They really, really want to play. You know, these are guys who, from the time that they were children, not only bought into the dream of playing in the NBA, but bought into its mythology, you know. A few years ago, I remember there was a story about LeBron James, I believe it was in Sports Illustrated, you know, where he talked about, you know, I have this guy in Chicago that I'm trying to catch. And he's talking about Michael Jordan, you know, and trying to, right, catch these six championships that Jordan won. You know, LeBron's at three right now. These are people who measure time in terms of seasons. They measure success in terms of championships, you know, and you really need to remember, again, that a player like LeBron James, a guy like Kawhi Leonard, the reason that they're that good is because, right, it's not just that they're talented, but they've also worked very hard because that's their life, right? That's what they do. They want to win championships. And so just even like at a basic level, I think when we look at like what the Bucks did yesterday, and again, like Milwaukee has won only one NBA championship in its history, and that was way back in 1971, right? So most of their fans have not seen this team win a championship. They go on and win a championship, it'll change each of their lives forever, right? There will be heroes in Milwaukee.
And they have the best regular season record of any team in the league.
Exactly, right? And they're up, you know, 3-1. They're about to advance. You know, they're in prime position to win this. And for them to walk away from that, I mean, just take that at that basic level. And I think anybody, right, any of us, right, I'm sure you, me, you know, those of us who are fortunate enough to have jobs that we love doing, we understand how hard that is, right? I mean, you know, just even at the times, you know, last couple of months, you know, we had furloughs one day a week, right? So we, you know, we were forced to work 4 days instead of five. people on the staff complained about that, right? Because we want to do what we've, you know, worked hard to get to this point to do, you know, and it's with these basketball players, that's definitely the case. So the fact that they were able, you know, this wasn't just like a symbolic protest, you know, after the game or something, you know, making some kind of gesture. They actually walked away from the thing, you know, and at that moment, you know, you can say whatever you want about the right. But like, they did not know what the consequences were at that point. Now you could say, okay, well, the NBA, you know, given that, you know, they've been fairly supportive of their players, you know, they probably weren't going to get punished that much. But you know what? At that moment, they didn't know, right? The other,
yeah,
right? And so I think we really need to kind of start from there, that this is, they view this that seriously.
All right.
I would just kind of hope, right, just as a fellow human being, that if somebody is viewing a situation that seriously, that other people can recognize that as well.
We're talking with columnist for the Los Angeles Times, Dylan Hernandez, also joining us from the Athletics podcast, The Lead, host Kavitha A. Davidson. Kavitha, good to have you with us. What do you see as the potential impact, not just on the world of sports, but on social justice issues of what the players did last night?
I mean, I think that we saw the immediate ripple effects of what the players did unfold in just a matter of hours, right? We suddenly saw three MLB games get canceled. We saw Naomi Osaka withdraw from the tennis tournament. We saw five of six MLS games get canceled and all of the WNBA games slated for last night as well. So, you know, these actions that these NBA players and beyond have do have consequences beyond just the immediacy of what happened yesterday and tonight's games being postponed as well. But I think that, you know, the questions going forward are how can they actually achieve these tangible things that they are asking for? And we shouldn't forget that they're not just doing these protests in a symbolic way. They are asking for tangible, real change. The Milwaukee Bucks didn't leave their locker room last night until they got on the phone with the Wisconsin AG and the lieutenant governor. And they came out with a statement basically telling the Wisconsin legislature to come back, to reconvene, to come back to session in order to pass police reform bills that had been introduced back in June. I think that NBA players are tired of having to do this every time a black man gets shot in America. And I think the hope when George Floyd was killed and when this groundswell of support for this movement came about nationwide was that they wouldn't have to take drastic action like this again. But what they did was they showed that this isn't just lip service, that they're not just you know, making gestures without anything to back them up. They are actually willing to walk away from these games, and they are making the statement that we will not entertain America until America loves us back.
Yeah, sadly, we're going to almost certainly see at some point undetermined a shooting by a police officer of an African-American man or woman under questionable circumstances. What do you think is the next step, Tanya, that might be the escalation of the players' protests? Kavitha?
Sorry. So the next step, I think, would be exactly what they were calling for yesterday, which was, you know, when the Lakers and the Clippers decided after that players meeting that we are willing to walk out on the rest of the season unless we hear something from our owners. Now they're trying to get the billionaires who employ them involved and who wield, frankly, quite a lot of political and financial influence in their local municipalities. If you just take Milwaukee, for example, I've brought this up quite a few times in the last 24 hours. The Milwaukee Bucks got $400 million of funding from the state of Wisconsin for a new arena. So these players are now saying, we are putting our money where our mouth is. We want you not to just support us in words, but support us in action. We know that you can get policy changed, so support us in that way. And it'll be really interesting to see what the NBA and what these owners come out with in the coming days.
Thank you so much, Kavitha Davidson of The Lead podcast from The Athletic and Wondery Media. My thanks to columnist for the Los Angeles Times, Dylan Hernandez. Earlier, we spoke with the Times Lakers beat reporter, Tanya Ganguly. In case you just joined us, the NBA playoffs will likely resume tomorrow as games scheduled for today will be postponed. But we're still waiting for definitive word as the owners continue to meet. The players wrapped up their meeting earlier today. Multiple reports are that they have agreed to resume the playoffs, most likely starting tomorrow. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. A pleasure to have you with us. I hope you'll join me tomorrow for Film Week at 11 o'clock. Our critics review Bill and Ted Face the Music, the third in the Bill and Ted films, reuniting Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter. Also, Rising Phoenix, a documentary on Netflix about the Paralympic Games. Also, a documentary about Robin Williams, later stage of his life as he was battling a deadly neurodegenerative disorder. This documentary, which was near and dear to his widow's heart, the film Robin's Wish. We'll hear what our critics think. And a documentary about the first African-American high school rowing team in the country, made up of young men from the west side of Chicago. The documentary is A Most Beautiful Thing, and it's streaming on the new NBC Universal Peacock streaming service. So those are just a few of the films our critics will tell you all about. A number of them quite promising. That's tomorrow, 11 o'clock, Film Week, here on KPECC. But we turn our attention now on Air Talk to concerns about what life is like inside the bubble of nursing homes. We know that nursing home deaths have generated about 40% of the overall fatalities from COVID-19. They have been the most critical centers of the coronavirus outbreaks with the most vulnerable population. But the question is whether some of the measures that nursing homes have introduced to try and control the spread of COVID-19 have unnecessarily infringed on the residents of those nursing homes. Joining us is KPECC health reporter Jackie Fortier, who's written about this. Jackie, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So you've reported that there are nursing home residents who want to be able to come and go on their own and have been told they're locked down, that they're not free to do that. If they leave, they can't come back. Explain a little bit about the reasoning behind this.
Yeah, I mean, I found that dozens of complaints are filed with county officials every week by nursing home residents here in LA who are desperate to leave, but they've been threatened with eviction by nursing home administrators if they do. I mean, they can't even go for a walk around the block, and they haven't been outside of their facilities in over 5 months. And all of this is because of restrictions that were put into place due to the coronavirus. Like you alluded to, the nursing home residents are usually medically frail. We've seen a lot of infections in nursing homes, over 2,100 deaths in LA County alone. On average, between 7 and 9 nursing home residents die every day in LA County from COVID-19. But a lot of the people, residents in nursing homes, want to be able to leave and have a modicum of autonomy, and they haven't been able to do so.
It's one of the problems that the employees there, they can mask and are expected to mask and wear PPE throughout the course of the day. But the residents, many of them, because of their compromised health, just can't realistically be in their rooms once they return from the outside and stay masked all the time.
Well, nursing home residents are actually supposed to be masked most of the time when they're around anyone, including someone who works for the facility. So they do wear masks quite a bit. I mean, employees come and go because, they have to. They have lives and they live outside of the facility. They're supposed to have appropriate PPE, which includes masks and gloves and gowns. Those definitely are issues. But I mean, one thing that nursing home administrators told me is that they wouldn't be able to quarantine nursing home residents who left when they got back and control the potential for bringing infection back into the facilities. Now, advocates for residents would push very hard against this because we're still having a very hard time testing in all of these facilities to begin with. So the implication that the resident is going to bring in a COVID infection when most of these already have COVID-19 outbreaks, which is in a different part of the facility than what I'm talking about. I'm talking about residents who do not currently have COVID-19 who want to be able to leave. They would push very hard against that argument.
We're talking with KPCC health reporter Jackie Fortier. I'd love to hear from you, your thoughts about this. If you have a loved one in a nursing home, a skilled nursing center, what do you think about whether the residents should be able to come and go? Or do you think that that would put too much risk on the other residents who are bedbound, who are not able to come and go, or on the staff? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. I look forward to hearing your thoughts on this, particularly if you have someone who is close to you who is in a skilled nursing facility. Also with us, Research Associate Professor of Gerontology at USC, Donna Benton. Thank you very much, Professor Benton, for being with us. Speak, if you will, to the tremendous psychological challenges that residents of nursing facilities are facing as a result of lack of contact with the outside world.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, particularly for the residents, those that may not have any kind of cognitive impairment, we're certainly seeing more of a sense of hopelessness and helplessness, feelings of anxiety, and particularly isolation, even though they have people around who might be the workers there or facility directors. What they don't have is the ability to talk to family and friends that may have been coming in prior to the lockdown because of COVID-19. So while, you can get on the phone or they might be able to have virtual visits via electronics, that's really never can substitute for many of these residents the touch of a hand or somebody's a smile that you can genuinely see someone's face, even if it's 6 feet away.
Yeah, the last visit I had with a friend in a skilled nursing facility, I was able to be with him as he was doing his physical therapy, and it was wonderful because being part of the process, being there, he said it was really helpful. It was really nice. That's something you can't do. The most recent visit I've had, not in person, was a Zoom session with a woman who's in a skilled nursing facility. And we had a wonderful Zoom session for her 85th birthday. It was great. But it's just not the same as being there in person. And there's that longing, to be close to someone physically, and the power of that. Again, I'd love to hear from listeners. If you have a loved one who is in a skilled nursing facility, maybe you're a listener and in a skilled nursing facility now, share with us about how you deal with that inability to get outside in the world and to spend time with your loved ones. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Professor Benton, do you have any recommendations for ways of Zoom, telephone calls, of rebuilding that connection?
Well, part of the rebuilding right now is, obviously we're very concerned about the safety first, but you can try to get things that are tangible and help the person feel like they're still connected to those that were coming to visit. So maybe you send more cards than you usually do instead of just on birthdays and holidays like you might do before. Send postcards and little gifts more often. See if it's possible to deliver probably something that you might have brought with you before, like, oh, I used to, sneak in some chocolates, or I would send in a special meal from the outside that we would share, a sandwich or something. See if that is still possible to bring to the facility. and have those kind of little touches that would allow something that's tangible that the person can hold. Maybe go through old photos and instead of looking at a photo on a phone, actually putting together a photo book or turning it into a mug. Now you can make mugs and blankets with pictures on them. Something that they can that's look at that's different,
yeah,
creative, and enjoyable.
Yeah, that sounds great. We're talking with USC professor, researcher in gerontology, Donna Benton. She also directs the Family Caregiver Support Center and the LA Caregiver Resource Center at SC. KPECC health reporter Jackie Fortier, so what are the legal options available for residents who want to go out and effectively can't because of the eviction threat?
Well, I mean, it's really a gray area right now. The health department in LA County is really giving nursing homes a lot of leeway with their mitigation plans. So if a resident is informed informed with text, right, it has to be written down that if they leave, they will be evicted from the facility. That may hold water. So if they leave, they might not be able to get back in. If they're told verbally by staff, that's just not adequate. And that's what's happening in a lot of these facilities. I mean, residents who I talk to are terrified of getting evicted because a lot of them don't have anywhere else to go. So it has to be given to the resident in writing.
All right, Jackie, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Also, thanks a couple weeks ago for you filling in for one of the days that I was off. It was wonderful to have you sitting in this seat and hosting Air Talk. Thank you, Jackie. We appreciate it very much, and good work on this story. We'll look forward to your continuing coverage of these important health issues. Jackie Fortier, KPECC reporter. Our thanks to Professor Donna Benton. Let me share some listener thoughts. Dove in Beverly Woods says, I volunteered at a nursing home every Friday, but I haven't been able to go since COVID-19. One of the women there I loved very much passed away, not from COVID, and I can't help but feel, had I been able to visit her and be there, that would have helped her. I'm so sad that I couldn't be there. Dove, I understand. It's a terrible feeling to have that separation. And Juanita in Santa Monica said, my mother-in-law was in a nursing home, passed away in April from Alzheimer's. She was in a rehab facility, and we wanted to move her to a nursing home, but she wasn't able to do it because of COVID concerns. It was very hard because we couldn't visit. Reminder that this afternoon, or evening, I should say, at 6 o'clock, it's the final night of the Republican National Convention. You'll hear NPR's live coverage coming out of All Things Considered, 6 o'clock, right here on KPECC. President Trump will be giving the closing speech as he formally accepts his party's nomination. And then tomorrow on Air Talk, we'll look back at the 4 days of the convention, find out what listeners have to say about it, and talk about the convention. That's tomorrow on Air Talk, right here on KPECC. Right now, our focus is on police reform and a series of bills that were introduced in Sacramento coming out of the police killing of George Floyd and the nationwide protests that ensued. Just about a year ago, California came up with a fairly significant police reform measure that had to do with the threshold for using deadly force. But there are a number of measures that go well beyond that, and with us to talk about them, Los Angeles Times staff writer who covers California state politics, Anita Chabrier. Anita, good to have you with us again. We appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So let's talk about the momentum that was there coming out of the protests. Did it appear early on when these bills started getting introduced that there was a lot of momentum toward passage?
There absolutely seemed to be. You saw almost 70 state legislators come out on the Capitol steps and take a knee for George Floyd. You saw these bills being introduced very quickly, and a lot of folks during press conferences and showing solidarity and really building on the energy of those protests.
So now we're up against a very tight deadline. I know Monday is the formal passage deadline, but there's an earlier deadline because of the law to try and avoid the sort of last-minute sausage-making of bills. So what's the deadline that the legislators have to hit for putting these up to a full vote?
Well, they have until Monday night for the actual vote to happen, but you're absolutely right. Any changes, any amendments to the bills have to be done 72 hours in advance of the vote. So Friday, really, is their deadline for hashing all this out.
So is that midnight tomorrow we're looking at?
Just about. It depends on, you know, when it would come up on the floor. But yes, you'll see it go right up to the last minute that they possibly can.
Let's talk about one of the most far-reaching. It's from Gardena-based Democratic State Senator Stephen Bradford. And his bill, which would expand, from your article I'm taking this, Anita, expand the public access to public police records. There also are the most controversial part, stripping bad officers of their certification to be able to serve. And what is the, to this point, effective pushback that's come to Bradford's bill to essentially decertify problem officers?
Well, Bradford's bill actually doesn't deal with records. That's a separate one. But Bradford's bill does have two parts, which is this decertification. And it also, right now, you can't really, an officer can't be found financially liable in a civil suit. And it would give them some financial liability if they're sued. The pushback on both sides of that is very great right now. In terms of being sued, a lot of agencies are saying that if officers are going to be financially liable, even partially, that's really going to make a lot of people question whether they want to be in the profession. It'll really hurt recruitment and retention of officers. And on the other side, when it comes to decertification, it's actually a little bit more nuanced. Most agencies in the state don't oppose having some kind of statewide process for decertifying cops that break the law. In that side of it, it's more that the devils are in the details, and they're saying that the bill as it's presented, they feel, goes too far in including a civilian panel that would have a lot of power and is just a little rushed and doesn't really consider existing labor laws.
And Bradford is proposing, I think I read in your article, Bradford's bill proposes that there be people who've been victimized by police on that panel to determine that.
Yeah, and that's really one of the things that cops are very troubled by. It would be a 9-person panel at the state level that included 3 people from law enforcement, but then the rest would be made up of family members of that have had a family member impacted by police violence, or organizations that had worked on police reform in some way. Bradford is very clear that when he's talking about those community groups that have worked on violence or academic groups, that those don't necessarily that doesn't necessarily mean they're anti-police, that there's lots of groups that are more neutral than that. But the police really view that that 6-person component of the panel of family members and community groups as being anti-police.
Yeah, well, and there also is the issue of expertise. I assume that's been raised as well, is a family member who suffered a terrible tragedy knows more than anybody else the costs, but doesn't necessarily know from a tactical perspective about the particular incident setting in front of them? Or would there be specific training that Bradford proposes for everybody that they'd have to go through a fairly substantial process to understand that sort of decision-making?
I don't think that there's anything in the bill specific to training, and that is actually one of the big concerns of police. They point out that you wouldn't have someone who's not a medical professional judging the license of a doctor is what you'll hear them say. And that is a valid concern because the policies of officers and how that works can be complicated.
We're talking with Anita Chabria of the Los Angeles Times. Anita covers state politics and policy for the Times. We're talking about the bills in Sacramento that are about policing reforms and where they stand as we head toward a Friday night deadline for the bills to be considered for final vote by Monday. What are some of the other bills beyond Steve Bradford's decertification and outside review?
Well, there is a bill to expand further the public records that we have access to allow all use of force incidents to be publicly available. That was that's building on a 2019 bill that opened up a lot of deadly use of force records and sexual assault records, but we're still waiting for a lot of those records. Even though the law exists, they haven't been released. There's also a Assembly Bill 66, which deals with firing tear gas and rubber bullets, and that's very much of the moment, responding to how some of the protests were handled in the wake of George Floyd. That actually wouldn't ban their use, but it put some serious restrictions on how and when they're used in protests. And then there's a series of other bills that are more moderate reforms, things that would allow more media access to protests, one that would require some screening for bias in officers. But then there's a number that has just died out already, including one that was called the George Floyd Law, that would have required officers to intervene if they saw a fellow officer using excessive force. So it's a real mix of what's moving forward and what's not, and it's very uncertain how many of these will actually make it to a floor vote.
Yeah, Chris Holden was on talking about that last bill with us. The recent UC Berkeley poll asking Californians about policing, 80% of respondents favored making it easier to prosecute officers using excessive force. Nearly 80% favored banning chokeholds, which most departments have done that. 70% favored giving civilians the right to sue officers for misconduct and excessive force. Did those polling results showing that degree of public support for reform, is that holding much sway in Sacramento?
You know, Sacramento really is a lot about lobbying, right? So you see that generalized support, but what that translates to in the legislature is very different. You know, the police unions were sort of off kilter in 2019 when they were sort of taken by surprise by the public support and really the people in the streets demanding change. You're not seeing that now. The George Floyd protests have faded, and I think that makes it more difficult for these laws to move forward. We now, of course, have the energy around Jacob Blake. Very tragically, you're seeing people back in the street over that shooting. I think that might play into the next couple of days very strongly. But it really takes that kind of public pressure of people in the street sometimes to get legislators' attention.
I was going to say, with the NBA starting off the pro sports boycott last night and all the attention on this, also the protests that have been held in cities like Los Angeles last night, if that might juice the passage of these bills.
I think absolutely you're going to see Jacob Blake's name invoked if any of these bills get onto the floor. It's so tragic that it takes something like that, but I absolutely think it will play into it. But I can't stress enough that the Capitol is in chaos once again in the past 24 hours because a San Diego senator has tested positive for COVID, was in the building. And so now they're having to have folks tested and having to, you know, decide how those people that need to quarantine are going to vote and things like that. So in these final hours that were already chaotic, they now have to contend on the Senate side with this whole new layer of chaos.
Wow.
So we just don't know how this session is going to play out. It is like nothing anyone has seen.
COVID-19 rears its ugly head again. Thank you so much. We appreciate your talking with us, Anita, and filling us in on the latest on Sacramento. Are you doing your reporting all at a distance, or are you in the Capitol building and able to report from there?
You know, in 2020 fashion, I have actually been reporting on fires for the last couple days.
Oh, okay, because that, of course, is...
The fires, but yes, you can go to the Capitol. Okay. We are doing a lot remote.
All right. Anita Chabrier, thank you so much covering California state politics and fires for the Los Angeles Times. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
So good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Reminder, the final night of the Republican National Convention comes your way from NPR, 6 o'clock, right out of All Things Considered, here on 89.3. Tomorrow morning, we'll talk about the four-day convention. We'll hear listener perspectives on it. Also tomorrow, as we do every day, our update, the latest on COVID-19. And that's what we're going to do for the remainder of today's program. I'm so pleased to be joined by Huntington Hospital in Pasadena infectious disease specialist, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Dr. Schreiner, good morning.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. One of the things, as a man, that I found fascinating about COVID-19 is how we get hit harder, and in some cases, much harder, it appears, by the novel coronavirus. And we have a study that was published yesterday in the journal Nature that suggests that men, particularly those over age 60, I'm sad to say, may need to depend more on vaccines to protect against the infection. And it finds that men produce a weaker immune response to the virus than women. Now, I misunderstood what you have to say about that generally, but that surprised me because I thought one of the biggest problems with the complications from COVID-19 was an over-response of the immune system. Can you explain a bit?
Well, it's kind of complicated, but I think you've sort of hit the nail on the head. What happens, Larry, there is definitely a gender difference. We've noticed that actually from the very beginning. And men in general tend to be a little bit more susceptible to infectious diseases, and there's some thought that this is related to having only one X chromosome. Conversely, women tend to have many more problems with inflammatory diseases like lupus and so forth because they have two X chromosomes. So that may account for some of the gender difference. There's also some suggestion that the virus is sequestered in testes, so that may be another source of ongoing viral shedding. But what happens in COVID is that you want to have a good, appropriate immune response early in infection when you first encounter the virus. And so you want to be able to battle it off and do what the immune system is ready to do. The over-inflammatory reaction that happens occurs well into the course of the disease. And that's where the virus just sort of insinuates itself into the immune system and basically causes a short circuit, and so it becomes very hectic and scattered and in an inappropriate response. And that's when a lot of the really serious disease manifestations of COVID show up. So early on, you want a good immune response, a normal immune response, and later to sort of basically keep it in check. And then later, sometimes if it doesn't stay in check, then it can turn into this really bad inflammatory situation.
But I had thought, and I may be off base on this, that women were more prone to autoimmune diseases where the immune system over-responds. And is that the case with COVID-19, that's more likely with women to have that sort of chaotic immune system response? Or are we seeing that more in men, and that's why men have worse outcomes?
No, you're absolutely right. Women have a higher incidence of autoimmune diseases, and that's because they may have two X chromosomes. The X chromosomes, certain parts of the X chromosomes control immune response. And so so women don't have aren't higher risk for developing the hyper-inflammatory response that we see in COVID. That really is a manifestation of more progressive infection and deeper infection. And so it basically as I said, sort of short circuits the normal immune response. So the gender difference is probably perhaps a poor or less robust normal immune response when men first encounter the virus. And then what happens later can happen to anyone once the virus is well established, and it can produce this hyperimmune inflammatory response.
Well, thank you. Now I understand that so much better then, that they're really two entirely different processes. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital, with us. If you have questions like I do, you just want answered because something doesn't quite make sense to you, or you were led to believe something else that now seems different, chance for you to get some clarity on that from Dr. Kimberly Schreiner at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Dr. Schreiner, it appears that Disney and Universal are making the case that they are now prepared to reopen their theme parks in Southern California. The LA Zoo is reopening to the public. What do you think about the prospects for the theme parks? Can they enact protocols that could keep visitors safe?
I hope so, because those are very risky endeavors. But, you know, I think we all are coming to the realization that we're going to have to live with this thing for a while, and so we're also going to have to function with this thing. And I think that we're just going to have to be flexible and come up with plans where we can manage risk in an appropriate fashion, but also continue on with our lives. The problem with the theme parks is the congregant business. And, all of us have been on rides at Disneyland and the Universal Studios and so forth, and they're just crammed in there. So, you know, it's a little scary. I think that there would be no question that we're going to see an uptick in diseases coming out of those venues. But I think that, you know, with very, very careful monitoring, and again, this is where testing is just so very important, and we really do need to continue testing people, whether they have symptoms or not, because that really helps us identify contact cases. So if we can institute some type of quick, easy test at the theme parks over the next few months, maybe that's a way of doing it, certainly making appropriate distances. I think the LA Zoo is now saying you have to stay a zebra apart.
That's funny.
It scares me, and yes, those are very risky endeavors, but I do think that we are going to have, this is sort of our new normal. It's not normal, but it's our new normal, and so we have to begin to come up with plans on how we're going to cope with this going forward over the next many months.
And it seems to me one of the biggest challenge is enforcement. And obviously, you know, operators of theme parks don't like to be in the position of having to use security as enforcers, you know, whether that's because a fight's broken out or, you know, people start yelling at each other, anything like that. But now you add to that someone who takes off a mask or refuses to wear it or gets mad and coughs on someone, you know, the kinds of sorts of petty things that we've seen people do during this time of COVID-19. And I know you're a doctor, not you don't have an MBA with emphasis in theme park operation, but you think it would have to come down to the parks? They're going to have to be the enforcers. They just can't leave the public to do that.
Well, I think here's an idea. How about that the theme parks make, when you first enter the theme park, you pass through Corona World. And Corona World is an educational walkthrough type thing, maybe, where you have a lot of information on how to not transmit the virus. You learn how to wash your hands properly. You learn how to wear a mask properly. You might even make it a ride of some sort, so that it's part of the experience, but that it's a mandatory thing that people have to pass through that educational venue before they can sort of get a passport, if you will, to go into the theme park. I don't know. That might be one sort of creative way of doing a little bit of education and encouraging people to be participants in this. We have to make it so that everybody's engaged and that they feel like they're doing their part to not only protect themselves and their families, but to protect other people and be a good citizen. So however you can facilitate that, I'd be happy to come up with some kind of ride that you could go on.
That sounds...
It could be a neutralizing antibody. Or...
Yeah, it might creep me out, but it's an interesting idea. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner with us on Air Talk, and I would not be surprised that you would have waivers and kind of mini contract you'd have to sign when you go into the theme park that you agree to abide by the rules, that, of course, giving the management leverage to deal with people who flout the rules. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Your questions for Dr. Schreiner. Topaz in the Crenshaw-Jefferson area said that she had heard in New Zealand they're using a 15-minute turnaround test. Can you talk a bit about access to rapid testing? Who has that? Is it a good thing? Can we get more of it?
Well, the answer is it is being developed. There's a big push to sort of lots of people. There's many different entrepreneurial companies are developing it. Many even big institutions are looking into it. The problem with rapid tests is they are very good at screening large populations in terms of sort of getting a rough idea of how much disease you have out there. They're not so good at deciding whether one individual has a positive test or not. If they have florid COVID, it usually picks it up. But there are many patients that have sort of the early stages of COVID where the test is inaccurate, and so they might actually be infected and infectious and that the test is negative. So I think they are going to be a very important tool in trying to open up society. And yes, there now are many platforms looking at that kind of where you just basically put some saliva on a piece of paper and within a few minutes you get an answer. But again, the accuracy is not very good. So you don't want a tool that you're going to use a lot and depend on it and then it doesn't work very well. So there's a lot of studies going on right now. City of Hope is developing some some platforms like that, as are other big institutions. But also there's a lot of commercial entrepreneurial areas as well.
866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Steve in West Hollywood asks, is there anything beyond volunteering for a vaccine trial that a healthy person can do to aid the medical cause?
Oh, there's lots of things to do. You can certainly reach out to communities that need help with food banks and special services. You can certainly be a good mentor for people to wear masks and be a proponent of that. There's lots of things. You can do creative things, a lot of things on websites. There's a lot of, I think there's several venues you can go to where they need volunteers to do things. And it really is going to be a collective effort to get over this thing. It's just an enormous problem. And, really, it just hit us so hard that I think everybody's just still kind of reeling from it. But there's many, many things to do to volunteer. And I would encourage Steve to look on line and see where he can help, even simple things like with Salvation Army and stuff, but certainly with lots of food areas and encouraging people, dispensing masks and so forth.
All right. We have many more listener questions, excellent questions. We'll be presenting to Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Dr. Schreiner, one of our all-star in our daily lineup of COVID-19 experts answering your questions. I've been getting more response from listeners to this daily segment than anything that we do, and I'm so glad that you're appreciating it. Speaking of John Horn's podcast, Hollywood, the sequel, we're going to have an excerpt of John's interview with the gifted costumer, Ruth Carter. Her designs are, if you've seen Black Panther, so many films that she's done the costumes for, going back to Spike Lee's school days back in the late 80s. But moving well beyond just working on Spike's films. She's working on the Coming to America reboot that's doing. Dolomite Is My Name with Eddie Murphy. The costumes for that were just extraordinary in evoking the 1970s. That's conversation you'll hear on Film Week tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour, our John Horn with Ruth Carter right here on KPCC. Right now, I'm with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, Huntington Hospital infectious disease specialist. We're taking your calls at 866-893-KPECC. We have so many good questions. I have to figure out where to start. But let's go with Joe, who asks, the World Health Organization Director General said over the weekend, there's no certainty a vaccine will be developed. And even if it is, it won't end the pandemic. Is there a plan B for therapy? Joe asks. Dr. Schreiner.
That's a really good question, a very legitimate question. I think that there are other opportunities and options. you know, I think that we look to previous pandemics, especially the HIV pandemic, and, you know, we're 35 years into that particular pandemic, and we still don't have a vaccine. But we have very, very good therapy. And basically what that therapy has done is not only protected people who are infected with HIV, but decreased transmission. And so I think that's a possible modality, looking for more therapeutic drugs that can be given to people with COVID virus to get them through it, perhaps to give it to people prophylactically who are at risk, healthcare workers, teachers, and so forth, or post-exposure prophylaxis. I think all of those things are modalities that can help decrease the amount of disease that's circulating in the population, and that might be Plan B if we don't, if the vaccines don't work out. And I wish there was a little bit more money put into that, those kind of ideas, because I think that is a good backup.
I'm a little surprised. I didn't hear the director of WHO say that, but do you think that's really possible? We won't have a vaccine?
Well, there's a lot riding on the vaccines, and there's a lot of problems with it. The first is that we don't know how long the vaccine will give you immunity. So if you do a vaccine that gives you immunity for a year, most people will go ahead and get a yearly vaccine like we do with influenza. But it is possible that that won't do it for this virus, because we do see a decline in neutralizing antibodies after about 60 days. We hope that the virus, that the vaccine stimulates the adaptive part of the immune system, the T cells, the cellular part, because that gives you more prolonged immunity. But we don't know that. We also don't know, could the vaccine kind of sensitize you to the virus so that when you encounter the real virus, you actually get sicker? That's a very scary prospect.
Oh, no.
I don't think that's going to happen with this vaccine, but with these vaccines. But those are all possibilities. And it also is just, it's possible that it won't stimulate enough immunity to really help with getting everybody immune so we can stop the high burden of disease we have.
Joanne in Santa Monica asks, are there certain blood types making people more susceptible to the virus?
There's been a lot of conjecture about that. A positive is sort of thought to be perhaps a higher risk. We're not quite sure why that is. There may be some relationship with where the blood type genes are located and their proximity to inflammatory or markers or inflammatory genes. That may be part of it. I will tell you that, you know, we certainly have many patients who have O or B, and they either do very poorly or do very well, and I've had many patients with type A that have done well. So that's a little murky still, but the Chinese did report that fairly early on, and there's been some evaluation of that, but it's not well established.
Have we seen that with other coronaviruses?
I don't think it was ever looked at, Larry. The only other kind of beta coronavirus we've had to deal with has been SARS, the first SARS, and that kind of burned out very quickly after about a year. And then, of course, MERS, which is a different, it's also a beta coronavirus, the Middle Eastern respiratory virus, but it's it doesn't seem to, I don't think there's been any studies looking at that.
You're just mentioning about your patients. What are you looking at patient census for COVID right now? Are you down?
We're down. We closed one half of our ICU, but we're back to just having regular ICU patients and their non-COVID patients. But we're very, very concerned about the holidays, both starting with Labor Day and then increasing up. So we're trying to be, you know, it's important for hospitals, as I said, sort of with the theme park, that you have to learn how to live with this and how to function, because one of the things that our CEO has been very, very concerned about, and we all share that, is the collateral damage that happens when people that need to have surgeries are postponed because we're dealing with COVID constantly. So that's a really, really important factor. You see it all over the world with other diseases like malaria, HIV, tuberculosis, where those people are not having access to the really life-saving meds. So it's not just coronavirus that we're dealing with here. It's all kinds of diseases.
Reminder, you can tweet a question, AirTalk, at AirTalk, tweet a question for Dr. Schreiner. You can post one on the AirTalk Facebook page as well as post on the AirTalk Facebook page, where JSK posted, with the CDC changing its recommendations about who should get molecular tests, what besides the less accurate but cheap and quick tests can do much about reducing the spread of the virus in a semi-functioning society? If we can reduce the transmission rate below R1 for time, we could get to a point where we could live with the virus and at a more acceptable risk level. Thank you, JSK. Dr. Schreiner?
Yes, I would agree with him. I think that the molecular testing is much more reliable. It's not hard. It's not difficult to do. It's just difficult to preserve the specimen, and it's cumbersome. You have to have somebody who's an appropriate PPE to collect it, and it's more complicated. but it's much more accurate. Now, I do think there's a lot of room for some improved technology in that department as well, developing PCRs that can be done very quickly, very easily, without a lot of PPE and sophisticated collection materials. And so, you know, the CDC is faced with the shortage of testing platforms and testing materials, and so they have to kind of adapt things back and forth. They are walking back the testing thing a little bit after there was a great sort of concern about not doing enough testing. So, but again, the real fast tests are not very accurate, so that's just a problem. I think technology is, you know, continuing to improve, and we have, you know, very good, very quick tests for influenza. So we might be able to come up with something similar for that coronavirus.
Yeah. Did you find that a head-scratcher when the CDC said, unless you have symptoms, don't test?
Yes. I wasn't quite sure where that was coming from. We have to test. Testing is the way out of this. And we just have to continue to do it, because otherwise you never know what's circulating out there. We are very certain now that there's asymptomatic spreaders, and that seems to be how much of the disease is transmitted. And so you'll never pick those people up if you don't test them when they're not symptomatic.
Jeff writes on the Air Talk Facebook page, what are the current recommendations for wearing face coverings outdoors?
Well, I think, you know, that's sort of region to region and county to county. You know, for your own personal safety, you should wear a mask. And you should encourage everybody around you to wear a mask. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with asking people, could you put your mask on? Some people, you know, have a mask on their face and they have it on their chin. But when you're in close proximity to them, you should, you know, wear a mask. A cloth mask is adequate. The gator thing is still being studied. There's been some controversy about whether or not it might actually increase your risk of infection by kind of cleaving the micro droplets, making them smaller. You know, stay out in the open. Stay away from closed spaces. And crowds. It's not complicated. It's just, it's not something we naturally want to do. We want to be with our friends and family and enjoy people and have a good bite to eat and stuff. It's hard to give all that stuff up, but we have to right now. We're not giving it up, but at least adapt to it.
David in Temple City has a highly appropriate question given the high humidity that we've had over the past couple of weeks. He says, if we're outdoors running and wearing a mask, if it gets wet because we're sweating, does that make it less effective? Should I be switching out masks as I run, or are there better options?
It might be less effective. If you're running and there's nobody around you, you can take your mask off, because it's pretty hard to do a good jog with a mask on. But, yeah, it's probably better to carry some clean masks with you, because if it gets really soiled and wet, it may actually trap things in the mask. That's a possibility. But I think that, if you're out for a run, try to sort of keep, 20, 30, 40 feet away from people, and then you can probably take your mask off.
Okay. 866-893-5722. You can quickly get a question in, as we have just about 2 minutes left in our conversation with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner of Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Let's see. We had a question from a listener. Michael in Montrose. Have there been studies looking at recovered COVID patients and the long-lasting health effects they have from the virus?
Excellent question, and we're in the process of doing that, trying to look and see if there are long-term sequelae from this. We believe that people that have spent, certainly a long period of time on ventilators may have long-standing lung problems. The cardiac system needs to be studied very carefully. That's a really, really important question. And most of us who've taken care of COVID patients are trying to kind of keep track of them and assess any kind of symptoms. In my patients, one of the things, and granted, these people are only 3 or 4 months into this, but one of the things they still report is just terrible fatigue a lot of the time, or easy fatigability. And a few people have had loss of their sense of taste and smell for about 6 months now.
Wow.
Interesting observation that that can happen sometimes. So we don't know what the really long-term side effects are. Certainly people that have had a very rocky course in the hospital, they're at risk for some more serious things, so they need to follow up with their doctors.
Yeah, I didn't realize people were having a 6-month-long loss of taste and smell. That's that's got to be in and of itself very, very stressful to feel cut off from one's vital senses like that. Dr. Schreiner, as always, we so appreciate your time and your joining us. We have so many fans of yours who listen to your regular appearances on the program, and we thank you as always.
Well, you guys are doing a terrific job, and please support KPCC.
Thank you, Dr. Schreiner, and stay well. Thanks so much. We wish the best to your patients and the staff at Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. They're our neighbors just around the block from us here at our Raymond Avenue studios in Pasadena. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We just remind you that Film Week comes your way tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.